Okay, good morning. We're almost in the afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here, and I want to thank Francois for putting together this wonderful conference, and apologize that I cannot attend all of it. I would love to. So this mini course was prepared by Ander Holroyd, and so I'll be showing the slides that he prepared, though much of it is about our joint work, as well as work of others that we will survey, and he was unable to attend, so I'm representing him. So, so you'll see some of these pictures later. This is Poisson matching. This is stable marriage of Poisson and Lebesgue. This is gravitational allocation, and this is stub matching, which is relatively newer, and I'll come tell you about some of these later. So I apologize in advance to the experts here who have heard version of this over the years. So there will be updates that I think will be new to you as well. But I have to, start from some basics. It's a mini course after all. So we have. So this is about matchings of processes, and I'm going to commit a sin that is common in this area, which is to focus a lot on Poisson process. So one thing I kind of tend to complain about is that this is stochastic geometry is this fantastic area, but it's time to look at other processes, so zeros of analytic functions, determinantal, permanental, and so on, should get, scrutiny. And it's starting, but it's nowhere comparable to the level of the analysis of Poisson. And like many people who rail against sins, I'm going to commit it myself and focus on the Poisson. Almost all of this talk. So we have Poisson processes, either one or several. So here there are two Poisson processes, independent blue points and red points, and we're interested in matchings of them that are perhaps optimal in various senses. So how the kind of question we make. Ask is how short can we make the edges, but there are several criteria. So short could be in some kind of global optimum sense, but usually we look at the local optimum sense. So each think of an agent sitting in each red point and each blue point, and this agent is concerned in matching up with someone on the other side in as short an edge as possible. But these concerns are shared among all the people, or all the agents. So how is this going to work out? So there's various matching rules that come out of this general goal. Okay, so we're going to look at the intensity one Poisson process, which here is some picture in R2. The Poisson process. Now, as I mentioned, there are other processes that should get this level of scrutiny, and one of my favorites is the one that has been pursued the most by Sodin and Cyrosson. So they have three papers about it, but others have followed in their path. And this is so there is a up to scaling. There's a unique translation invariant process, which is consists of zeros of a Gaussian analytic function, and this is it. So if you take an to be just complex normal, so complex with the real and imaginary part are independent standard normals, and then you look at the series sum an z to the n over root n factorial. Okay, so you look at this series. So the ans are these random variables, and now the zeros of this turns out to be a translation invariant process. This is a one-line proof. Basically, when you write the covariance function, you write the covariance function of f of z and f of w. So this is a complex covariance function, so it's really the expectation of the product of this f of z and f of w bar. You will get e to the z w bar, because only the diagonal terms will contribute and you'll get the exponential coming out. And then once you do that, you realize that if you take this function and you translate, the function itself is not translation invariant, because if you translate and you compute the covariance function of the translated function, you get something different, but it's different by a factor which has no zeros, by some exponential factor. So it follows that the zero process itself is translation invariant. So this is just a very easy calculation. You translate this and calculate the covariance function of the translated process, and you see it's the same up to some factor with no zeros. Okay, so this is the one-line proof. So it means this is translation invariant, but it has wonderful, wonderful properties. For instance, it can be matched to a lattice with very small tails, with sub-Gaussian tails, and this is very different from a Poisson process. It's much closer to a lattice, much more rigid than Poisson, and in fact it's in some ways an analog and even more rigid than taking a Poisson process and doing Gaussian translations, and I'll come back to that process in the afternoon talk. Okay, so but today so for instance, looking at invariant matchings of such processes is a great topic that still needs further investigation. And here there will be much. We know there are much better moments than for Poisson. As I said, we'll mostly focus on just independent Poissons and a perfect matching schemes between the two colors. Okay, so what we'll be interested is in matching schemes that are translation invariant. So if we take the red process, the blue process, and translate them, then we want the matching rule to translate with them. However, in some cases we'll allow extra randomness. The most interesting processes don't involve extra randomness. And the personal favorite here, which is one where we still don't know the sharp estimate, so there's a big gap between the upper and lower bounds, is this Gale-Shapley stable matching, also which can also be obtained as a greedy matching. So let's describe that. So this has a simple description for which you don't need to know anything about Gale and Shapley, although that connection is interesting in itself. So this is the interpretation as an iterated greedy matching. So what you do, every red point looks for the closest blue point, and every blue point looks for the closest red point. If blue and red points are looking at each other, then we match them. Okay. So in other words, we match all mutually nearest neighbor blue and red points. And then we take those out of the matching game and repeat the same rule again with the remaining points, and iterate again and again. Okay, and the basic fact here is that no points will be left over. And maybe it's natural to expect it, but for the wrong reason. So it's not enough that the blue and red have the same limiting density to get this all points get matched. So if you take, if you take two lattices, maybe translated at random, and add one point to that, this will break the process. On the other hand, if you take two Poisson process and add one point to, say, one of them, well, it's still a Poisson. And even if you add it to a specific point, if you look at the Palm version, it doesn't break this. So the fact that two Poisson processes, when you apply this, you get perfect matching, that fact is very robust. So it can't be destroyed by adding or removing finitely many points from the two colors. So here's the proof why everything gets matched. So look at R is the event that we have some leftover red point, and B is the event that we have some leftover blue point. These events are invariant under translation, and because the Poisson process is ergodic, any such event must have probability 0 or 1. So R and B have probability 0 or 1. On the other hand, if you think of the algorithm as I defined it, it's impossible to have both red and blue leftover points, because if you have a red point that's left over, it means that each point it's looking at is not looking at it. Otherwise, it will be matched to that blue point. So red point keeps examining the blue points in order, and if there is a blue point left over, they will eventually look at each other. So when you want to write that down as a rigorous proof, you see that there is one enemy to confront, which is a descending chain. So if you have a process where you have a descending chain, so a red point looks at the blue point, but maybe that blue point prefers an even closer red point, and that red point prefers an even closer blue point, and so on, and then you can have an infinite collection of points where nothing is moving. However, it's classical and easy to prove that for Poisson processes, you do not have such infinite descending chains. Okay, so once you know that, then you can easily see that nothing can be left over in this. So it's impossible to have both a red and a blue left over. And if you have a red and blue left over, you just why is this red not matched to the blue? Because the blue, still has something it favors more, and you can just keep going, and you will get an infinite descending chain if the process stabilizes while leaving both red and blue points unmatched. So that's why the intersection of these events has probability zero. And now, by symmetry, the R and B are exactly symmetric events, so it's impossible that one of them has probability zero and the other has probability one. So now, enumerating the four possibilities for these probabilities, you see the only possibility we haven't excluded is that both these probabilities are zero. Okay, so it's a proof that both probabilities are zero by just eliminating the alternatives. Okay. Now one can prove this kind of thing in a more general setting using a mass transport argument, but in this case, it's completely elementary. Okay. So this is the kind of philosophical question I alluded to. Why did this work for Poisson process and it doesn't work just for points of the right intensity? And here is an example, right? So you have two lattices, and I guess the red lattice and the blue lattice, but we removed one point from the blue lattice. And here, of course, when we do this type of matching, we'll have a leftover red point right here. So why is this process worse than the two Poisson processes? And the key thing is the deletion and insertion tolerance, which are properties I'll come back to in the afternoon, that from a lattice you can tell when the point is removed. From a Poisson process you cannot tell. Poisson process or a process where you removed any point will have mutually absolutely continuous distributions. So here is the two-color stable matching, but to keep the picture viewable, it's done on a torus. And you see there are many long edges and many crossing edges. So, so one open problem is how long are these edges? So look at the tail probability or the average in the stable matching. And it's still surprising to me that this stable matching, okay, we just defined it in a greedy way. On a torus, it's even simpler because in a finite setting, what you can do is just take do one pair at a time. Take the closest red and blue point, match them, and repeat. So it's the same, gives you the same thing. And So some such a simple thing seems, at least so far, harder to analyze than the optimal matching. So for the optimal matching, we know for a long time the root log n asymptotics when you scale things properly. So proper scaling, as I've learned from David Aldiss, is always to put 1 point per unit area. So we take take a torus of area n, so root n by root n torus if it's in the plane, and we put down n points, n red points, n blue points. Then if we look at the average distance, the classic result gives root log n, and Joe has refinements of that. And that's for the optimal matching, where the algorithm to construct the optimal matching is much more sophisticated than this simple greedy algorithm I told you. Yet the greedy algorithm so far has resisted the detailed analysis. So I want to mention the conjecture that if you do the optimal one, you'll get. If you do the stable one, the greedy one I defined for you should get a log n on average, without the root. We don't know to prove that. We have some non-trivial power law bounds. So this is the minimal length matching. And here, despite appearances, no edges cross. Right? So it's easy to see if you had the two edges that are crossing in the optimal, where you optimize the total minimal length, then you could improve by just rewiring. So the global optimum has no crossing edges, while the stable one has. On the other hand, this global optimum really requires enforced central planning. So there has to be some central authority that tells every red and every blue who to match up to. And if that central authority is weakened and the points can make deals for themselves, then you will have pairs that will say, wait a minute, you know, I have a closer pair that I could match to than the matching gives me. So why am I matching to my current match? So in particular, if it's easy to find here, look at this red and this blue. Right? This optimal matching tells them, well, this red, in the interest of society and global welfare, you know, and society welfare, you should match to this far away guy. And this this blue is told the same, you should match this far away guy. But if they can just look at their own interests and each one wants to match to the closest one, then they will say, well, you know, no thank you, but we can make a better deal between us. And they will just break it. So the global optimum needs some powerful enforcer to keep it in place. Okay, here is the one-color stable matching. So again, the same greedy rule can be applied. So I still owe you the explanation of stable for those who haven't seen it. But just the same greedy rule can be applied with just one color, and the same proof still works to show that all pairs will be matched. Okay, so here there's no other color you can match to anyone else. And this is, the one-color minimum length matching. And we want to study this quantitatively. So we're going to look at x, the length of a typical edge, and how to, you know, what do we mean by typical? Well, the sophisticated answer is you look at the palm version of the process where we condition a point to be at the origin, and then look at that point. But another one to say is in terms of expectations, which is equivalent but more elementary to think about. So the probability that x is less equal r is just the expected number of red points in a unit volume where z minus the match of z is less than r. Okay, and then the question is, how small can we make x, or specifically, how small can we make the complement of these probabilities? So one trivial lower bound for the tails is, well, they're at least e to the minus constant r to the d, just because of the event that just because of the event that there's no other point in the to be matched to. But this trivial lower bound is, you know, in terms of moments, it means that the exponential diff moment is infinite. Now, one paper where we studied this was with Robin Pimentel and Oded Schramm in 2008, one of Oded's last papers. And there's been subsequent work by various other people, including some people here, Gunther, Hermann, others. So here are some bounds, and you know, if a larger mini course would be needed to go through explaining these, but we're just going to focus on a few of them and sketch the ideas. So, for instance, look at the two color case and any matching. And there are some a priori bounds. So without going into details about the key reason why dimension 2 differs from higher dimension is because the connection of the boundary to the standard normal fluctuations. So, for instance, in dimension 1 and 2, look at these bounds. So in dimension 1, we get the square root of x has infinite moment. In dimension 2, the x has infinite expectation. And once you go to dimension 3, and again, here we allow any matching. So we allow the matching to involve additional randomization. We just need the overall result to be translation invariant. And then suddenly, here you can have, for a different constant, you could have the diff moment, diff exponential moment finite. So radical departure from, you know, here only small moments, suddenly you go beyond exponential moments in dimension 3. And the real reason, but it's still surprising that it has such a strong effect, is that in two dimensions, the size of the boundary is still the same as the size of the normal fluctuations, so you don't somehow have, you cannot match points sufficiently to the outside. So the probability that x is bigger than r has to be, of this order. And while in dimension, in higher dimension, the fact that you have this extensive boundary allows you to match further away. So this is very heuristic at this point, and I won't go into more details on this. So, call a matching scheme a factor scheme if there's no extra randomness involved. So you define the matching as a function, a translation invariant function of the point processes. Okay? While otherwise it's randomized if you need additional randomness beyond that present in the point processes. And so there are some bounds on the behavior of factor matchings, and you see that they are different from the behavior of the randomized. And okay, so here are some results of Timar that showed even as a factor you can get essentially you could get some exponential moments. Okay, let me go back to one color and explain some connections here. So in one color, if you want to randomize, there's a trivial one which with exponential tails, just the nearest neighbor matching. Okay, so if I have one color in one dimension, I can just match every other point. And there are two ways to do that, so I just flip a fair coin to decide how to do it. Once I flip this fair coin, the process I get is translation invariant, but it involves this additional coin. And this coin is costly in the sense that if you're not allowed to use it, then it radically changes the behavior of the best matching. So here we, so when you do nearest neighbor matching, obviously you have, you get the exponential tails because the gaps in the Poisson process have the exponential tails. But the point here is that if you are, if you're doing a factor matching, that not only you lose the exponential tails, even the first moment becomes infinite for any factor matching. This is still an easy fact, so let me explain where this comes from. Okay, so this was the randomized, but it said there is no nearest factor, there's no factor. So what's easy to see is that if you want a nearest neighbor matching, it has to be the one I told you before, with the fair coin. There's no other choice. And so, and that one is not a factor. It needs this extra coin. Okay? So it turns out that this fact can be bootstrapped in order to control other factors that are not nearest neighbor. So now we want to show that any factor matching has infinite expected matching distance. And we're not assuming it's nearest neighbor, just that it's factor. Because there's no nearest neighbor which is a factor. So what's the proof? So there's a simple mass transport argument that says that the expected distance is infinite if and only if the number of edges crossing a line, a vertical line, has an infinite expectation. So let me quickly recall why this is. So let's take two unit intervals and define a transport rule where we say we're going to transport every Poisson point here which is mapped somewhere beyond here. We are whenever that happens, we send a unit of mass from this interval to this interval. Okay, so that's our mass transport rule. And now the mass transport principle tells us that if the expected mass sent out is infinite, then the expected mass coming into an interval is infinite. These two things are equivalent. But the expected mass sent out, I mean, in every interval, the number of points we have is, certainly has finite expectation. And so the expected mass sent out is just how many of these unit intervals. So we're looking at unit intervals just between integers. So the expected mass sent out is how many unit intervals we cross over, which is essentially the same as the expected matching distance. On the other hand, the expected mass sent into an edge like this is essentially the same as how many of these matching edges cross over. So that's a rough explanation for this equivalence. Okay, so it's certainly enough to show that with probability 1, infinitely many edges cross over the origin. And so suppose the opposite, that with positive probability, the number of edges crossing the origin is finite. And then again, by ergodicity, this number will be 1. Okay, and now, so it means the number of edges crossing over every point will be finite. Okay, now if we look, so these green edges are part of, long matching. So we're not doing a nearest neighbor matching. But we're counting how many edges cross over. So these are two of the Poisson points. How many edges cross over between them? Now when we cross one of the Poisson points, a new matching edge either ends or begins. Right? Because this point here, it's either matched to the left, in which case when we go left to right, this will end, or it's matched to the right, in which case we'll add an extra edge. So when we count between these how many edges we have crossing over, this number will change by 1 in every step. So it has to alternate between odd and even. We don't know if it goes up or down, but has to alternate between odd and even. But once we know that, we can obtain as a further factor of our matching just a matching of a nearest neighbor matching, because we can say, well, let's take the pairs that have an odd number and match them up to define a new matching. And this is a factor matching, and because it's a factor of a factor is already a factor, so we get the contradiction to the fact that the nearest neighbor matching is not a factor of the Poisson. So just from the assumption that there is a factor with finite expectation, we will conclude that the nearest neighbor one is a factor, which is a contradiction. Okay, so that's it. Okay, so Gale-Shapley involves matching all mutually closest red-blue pairs. And there's an alternative description, which is really equivalent, where you just grow balls around points and see when two balls meet, the points are matched. That's exactly the same. And there is one based on the Gale-Shapley stability criterion. So we have an unstable pair is a pair that prefer each other to their assigned mates. And Gale-Shapley proved that in a finite setting, you always have a stable matching. So you have preferences on the left and on the right. You always have a stable matching. Now, in their general setting, they allowed the preferences to be preference lists to be arbitrary, and then the stable matching is not unique. However, when this matching is done by distance, or more generally by a symmetric, according to some symmetric matrix, then the stable matching is unique, and it's constructed by this greedy procedure. And also, it works in the one-color case. So Gale-Shapley gave example that the one-color case, you do not have a stable matching if the preference lists are arbitrary. But when the matching is by distance, then it does work in the one-color case. Okay, and this is some quotes from the Shapley Nobel Prize. Now, Ander and friends have some game theoretic interpretation of this. So suppose, and this can be done in the two-color or one-color case. So suppose we have a game, Alice and Bob play a game on a Poisson point process. Alice places a token on any point of her choice. So Alice is the first player. Then Bob, in response, plays a token on any point of his choice. So the first steps for both of them, they have infinitely many choices. After that, the choices become finite because the rules of the game are the moves alternate, and a player can choose any of these tokens and move them to a closer point to the other token. So, for instance, so Alice moves first, and she moves either token to another point. She has to move it, decreasing the distance between the tokens. Okay, so she could move this one, or she could move the other one, as long as she decreases the distance. And there are no ties here, so there's no issue of ties. Okay, so the game continues this way. Now it's Bob's turn. He can choose either token and move it, decreasing the distance. So he chose the same token and moved it, decreasing the distance. And the game ends when a player cannot move. So who wins in this game? Alice, the first player, or Bob, the second player? So Alice can look at the whole process and choose really the best point for her, but after her choice, Bob can look at that choice and then choose somehow a best counterpoint. And after that, they, again, alternate moves. Once the two tokens are down, they can only get it closer. So who wins? Bob.
Yeah.
Why?
Because Alice cannot move.
In this particular example, yes. So is that true in general? Does Bob always win? Or are there... So with Poisson process, is there some... what's the story there? So it turns out that Bob always wins in the Poisson process. And the way he wins is by looking at Alice's move and using the... stable match point as his counter move. So whatever Alice does, Bob chooses the match stable pair. Now when Alice takes the next move and gets closer, then Bob can again take the match stable pair, which will necessarily be closer. So by just staying on the matching, he can ensure to win. Okay, and you can just the basic properties of the matching being stable ensures that he can always, when he moves to the match, so if Alice moves to a closer point, then when he moves to the match point of that's also closer. It just follows from the stability or the greediness. Okay, so in the two-color stable matching, there is a lower bound that the diff moment is infinite. And maybe I will skip this. So, but mention that this fact that the diff moment is infinite works whenever the point process is insertion tolerant or deletion tolerant. So what does this mean? You have a point process. It doesn't have to be Poisson, but it has the property that if you remove any point of the process, so you're allowed to look at the whole process, and as a function of that, remove any point, then or even randomly, the resulting process is absolutely continuous to the original process. So that's deletion tolerance. And insertion tolerance, you're allowed to insert a point, but now not at your arbitrary point, because if you insert a point exactly at the origin, of course you can detect that. But you're allowed to insert a point according to an absolutely continuous distribution. So in other words, say uniformly in some domain of positive finite area. If this cannot be detected, if this insertion cannot be detected, then it's insertion tolerant. And either of these properties is enough to ensure that the process will have this diff moment infinite. Here's an open question I asked back in 2002, and we still don't know it, although there's been various progress. So for independent red and blue one-point Poisson processes, intensity one Poisson point processes, is there any translation invariant matching in which the straight line segments joining the match points are disjoint? Okay, we don't know this. So, you know, if there was some kind of... So if you are doing this in a finite region, then there is always some method where the edges are disjoint, just use the optimal, global optimum, the one that minimizes the total length. But in the infinite case, you can't do that. So it's natural to try and minimize some expected distance, but there's no way to make the expected matching distance finite. So that method breaks down. And you can look at some other moments, but we don't believe that works. So I guess this is a question, but I guess I conjecture that there's no way to do it. But this is a weak conjecture. There's no real evidence. It's very easy to show that if you don't require invariance, you can match everything without crossing. And Andor also showed if you allow the edges to curve a little, then you can manage everything, even in a translation invariant way. This is non-trivial. Oops, wrong thing. Okay. So this is related to this global minimization, but I see that time is moving, so let me, towards the end, talk about the allocation problem, which is similar, but instead of one point to one point, you try to match every point of the process to positive area, and in fact, to the same area, that's the point. So if this is a unit one Poisson process, it will have to be to unit area. So this is the stable allocation, which you can construct in a similar way. So you have balls going around every point, and every point acquires area at the balls grow at unit rate, and when a point acquires its quota, it stops. So various notices here. So and an application is related to Hermann's work. So Hermann earlier showed that a point process, he gave a more general result. This is just a special case that Poisson and the corresponding Palm process can be shift coupled. So you can define a random translation that maps one to the other. And what we did is clarify that you can do this in a way which is a function of the original process. So without the shift just depends on the original process, but you can't do this in a way which just depends on the Palm process. Okay, so and here is the proof. You take any translation invariant factor allocation, like the stable allocation, and there is a cell that the origin is in. Now shift the point corresponding to that cell to the origin, and that will give you the Palm process. And Gunther and Hermann have various interesting extensions of this. This is the gravitational allocation. I see there's a typo there, but which was we analyzed with Shurav Chatterjee and Ron Peled and Dan Romick. And this is based on thinking of all the points applying a gravity force and then seeing the domains of attraction. And it turns out, beautiful corollary of Green's formula, first pointed out by Tsirlson, that the cells will have equal area in this case. So this is a whole, a topic for a whole, I gave a whole mini course on this at some point. So there's a paper in Annals Math and a follow-up in GAFA studying in detail the properties of this process. In particular, it has exponential tail decay, but it only works in dimension greater or equal 3. It really doesn't exist in dimension 2. In dimension 2, there's a beautiful idea of Maxime Cricoun from 2008, and he used the idea of the stable allocation in order to define connected cells. But he didn't apply the stable allocation directly in terms of the metric in R2. Rather, he said, let's, given the Poisson points, first build the minimal spanning tree on them. And Ken Alexander ensures us that the minimal spanning tree is indeed a tree. So, okay, and then you look at this minimal spanning tree and look at its complement. The complement is simply connected. So there is a Riemann mapping from that to the upper half plane, and you use the metric in the Riemann in the upper half plane after the Riemann mapping to define the matching. So it's very amazingly clever. It combines the metric from the upper half plane together with the area measure from the original plane, because you want the domains to be equal area in the original plane, not in the upper half plane. And so you still can follow this stable allocation rule in this setup and get domains that are provably connected. Now, they also seem to be bounded, but this is still open to show that the domains you get from Maxime's process are bounded. Now there is another procedure not written down, but found by Holroyd and James Martin, that will give bounded and connected territories for the two-dimensional Poisson, but it's rather more artificial. So whether this Cricoun procedure works, I think, is a beautiful problem that you know, I'd be happy to discuss with anyone interested. He has a paper on it, so you can find that paper published. And, okay, I see that my time is up. So I do have one more topic, but I think I'll steal some from my other identity as an afternoon speaker to, you know, I'll steal 5 minutes to tell you the last bit which I wanted to tell about this process. So maybe I'll stop here. Thank you. Yes.
Addison both choose their first points separately, right?
No. Bob looks at Alice's. So they alternate moves, and it's a perfect information game. So Bob sees what Alice chose. Even for the first move.
So there's probably something I did not get. Why wouldn't Bob choose the nearest point, the closest point to Alice?
Yes, so yes, that's right. So we maybe we can maybe we should draw this because it's a good question. So here is here is one color, and so this is Alice's choice, and and this may be the closest one for Bob, but then there could be another one here, right? And maybe the next one for Bob is out here. Okay, so. And then say all the other points are much further. Okay, so if Alice makes her first choice here, it would be a mistake for Bob to choose this closest one because there's a good counter move. These are matched to each other, but this one is the right choice. Okay, and after this one, if Bob chooses this one, then the only, because I assumed the other points are much further away, then the only move allowed for Alice is to go here. And then Bob can go here and win. Okay, but thanks. Good point.